All right, we'd like to welcome everybody back to class number two in Mastering the Art of Dementia Care. This is Eric Collette, your host and instructor, and it's good to have you back. Hopefully you've had lots of good time to think about and process some of the things that we talked about on our last call, and hopefully they've started to make a difference in your interactions with people that you're working with who live with dementia. Just by way of recap, there are a couple of key principles that we talked about on our last call. We laid some foundational understanding. We discussed the fact that humans cannot not communicate, so everything that we do is communication. And that's certainly true for people who are living with dementia. Everything that they do can be considered communication. And it's up to us to try to figure out what that communication means and to make sense of it and present things to them in a way that makes sense in their world. We also talked a lot about memory loss and how that occurs and what some of the implications of that are. And I gave the analogy that long-term memory is a lot like an onion or a tree, that it's multi-layered, that our earliest memories are like the core of that onion or tree. And when we have Alzheimer's disease and some other types of dementia, it's like peeling back those layers. So progressively people are living in the past. And we discussed the fact that if all a person has to orient themselves to the world is the distant past and the very immediate present, and there's a huge gap in between, then that person is going to have a lot of disconnects in trying to navigate everyday life. In other words, they think about life and life experience in a totally different way than the rest of us. We think chronologically, and we think step by step through our day. We can think about what happened in the morning, what happened after that, what happened midday, and we're able to follow the flow of a conversation. But if all you have is about the last 30 to 60 seconds and then the distant past, it means you're constantly living a life of improvisation. And it's there that I really want to pick up and go forward. If someone with dementia is living a life of improvisation, then it means that we have to really learn how to get on stage with them, how to be in the moment with them. And I mentioned last time that the real rule when you're improvising in terms of theatrical improvisation is that you never say no. Whatever a person puts out there, you just go with it. And it's also important to really learn how to be in that moment and what your lines need to sound like, how you need to stand, how you move. And I really like this theater analogy because it has pretty powerful implications for all of us when we're learning to interact with others that are seeing the world through that dementia lens. A lot of us that are on the call have responsibilities for training other people. And a long time ago, I watched my daughter in a theatrical production. And I was really impressed with the fact that young kids could get on the stage and they could learn their lines and learn how to stand and learn how to act in a very believable way, and that it could move an audience and affect them. And I started realizing that, gee, if kids can learn their lines, if they can learn how to move and how to behave and what all that is supposed to look like, then we can teach adults who are interacting with those living with dementia how to do that kind of a thing. So a lot of our time today we're going to spend talking about what things look like to the person with dementia and then how that applies to us in terms of our lines and how we need to respond and what we need to do. So in terms of learning our lines and being on stage with those that we're serving, one of the things we have to do is to learn how to talk like a friend. A lot of times we are so rooted in reality that we think about our actual role. We might think, oh, I'm I'm the facility administrator and I'm interacting with this person, or I'm a CNA and I have a job and my job is a list of tasks and that's why I'm here. And we need to get away from that thinking. Really, we're there just to be perceived as a friend with that person. We're helping them along the way. It's okay if they think that we're a family member even. That's a good thing. So what do friends talk like? Well, friends constantly say things like, I am so glad you're here. Or friends say, I don't know what I'd do without you. Or a friend walks up to us and says, wow, you look great. It's so good to see you. Or friends might say, we go way back. Or you make me smile. We could go on and on, but we all know what it's like to be around someone that is really respecting us as a friend. And those are the same kinds of lines that we have to use with people that we're serving who are living with dementia. But we have to do it in terms of their language. A lot of times I see younger staff members in facilities where I consult making the mistake of walking up to their elders and saying things like, hey, Bob, how's it going? And that doesn't make a lot of sense to Bob. We're working with people that have a hard time processing language. And when we use phrases from our time, instead of phrases that they would have used way back when, we put them at a disadvantage. And we don't sound like people that they remember in their world. What they remember is the distant past. And so if we say, how's it going? That's not necessarily how they would have approached people. They would have walked up to someone and said something like, well, fancy meeting you here. I took care of one gentleman from the South a few years ago, and I loved to walk up to him and say, well, how are you doing today? And he'd say, how am I? Well, I'd say, finer than frog's hair, split four ways. And I love that response. I've tried to remember that and use that with other people because that provokes a really positive reaction. If we can get someone laughing or at least feeling comfortable, like, wow, this person uses my language. This person knows who I am. Then it makes a huge difference. My wife's grandfather was famous for all sorts of sayings that kept us laughing. He would say things like, well, strip my gears and call me shiftless. Or if we were leaving, sometimes he'd smile and wave and he'd say, I'll see more of you in the bathtub. And I always thought that was just kind of funny. Now, one of the really common experiences that comes up when we're interacting with those living with dementia is that they look around wherever they are, and they might say, I have to go home. I need to get out of here. I need to go home. And if we stay rooted in the present, then we're going to do and say all sorts of the wrong kinds of things. So for a minute, I want you to just imagine that wherever you are in the world at this time, whatever room you're in, imagine that you have somewhere else that you have to be in an hour and 15 minutes. And let's say that this conference runs over a little bit. I just keep talking. I lose track of time. And it gets to be an hour and 10 minutes from now. You're supposed to be somewhere in an hour and 15 minutes. And so you decide to get off this call and you're going to leave. And imagine that you walk to the door and somebody rushes up and says, well, Eric, where are you going? Let's just sit down. We're having a good time here. You need to sit down. You know, you might tell them, well, I've got somewhere that I have to be. I'm sorry, I have to leave. Well, what if they said, well, you can't leave? What if you said, well, I've got an important appointment that I have to get to? And they said, well, no, you you actually live here. You've lived here for 3 years, and we're not going out right now. We'll go on an outing a little bit later, but right now you just need to sit down. Sometimes I run through the scenario with students that I'm teaching in college, and many of them have young children. And so they can believably imagine that they have to go pick up their child from daycare. And we actually role play this. And it's kind of fun to do with staff as well. You can role play them thinking that they have to leave and go pick up that child. And boy, that's important. You don't want to get in Mama Bear's way when she's going to pick up her cub. And if someone actually stopped you at the door and said, "No, you can't go." And you said, "Well, I have to go home. I've got to meet my child getting off the bus." What if someone honestly told you today, if that was you, they told you, "You can't go home. This is your home." And you might say, "Well, I've got to go pick up my son." And what if that person said, "Oh, I know it's hard to remember, but your son is 55 years old and he loves you so much. Oh, he's wonderful. He comes to visit 3 days a week. He's so loving and caring." Just imagine if that happened today. Oh, that would be hard. You wouldn't believe that. You wouldn't buy that. You might even fight with that person. And if you can imagine that really well, that gives you an idea of what many people living with dementia go through all of the time. We say things that completely contradict the reality that they are experiencing. So how do we deal with this? What is it that we do? I want to give you a few actual experiences that I've had over the years that I think illustrate several different ways to handle this effectively. So about, I'd say, 6 years ago, a family came to me, and they were really distressed. And as we talked more about how long-term memory deteriorates and this idea that people live in the past and there's a disconnect in their world, the light bulb kind of went on for this family. And they said, "Wow, now we understand a little bit why Dad might be trying to leave." And they went on to share that their biggest concern was that their father, every day, just before 5 o'clock, would try to leave the home that he had been living in for 30 years. And twice he was picked up in rush hour traffic in the middle of a very busy road near his home. Obviously not a good situation. And so the family started showing up every day. They'd have someone in the family there at his house to look out for him and to try to make sure that he was safe. But even though they were there, he was persistently trying to leave. And he'd say, "I have to go home." And they'd say, "Well, Dad, this is your home. You've lived here for 30 years. Look at your picture of the family reunion sitting over here. Remember that? Remember when that happened? And here's your wedding picture. And here's some pictures of me when I was a little child." And he would just get agitated. And he'd want to fight with him and say, "Well, I don't know what all that stuff is, but I have to go home." And finally, after we talked about this, they said, I realize he's living in a different world, so what do we do?" And I gave them two options. One was either to say, "Well, tell me about home." Or the other was to very believably as they could, kind of act stupid and say, "Oh, you're right. Except I forgot. What are we supposed to be doing?" And when they used those approaches, they finally got him to say, "Well, you know, the sheep." And that's when they really came to understand what was happening for this gentleman. They recognized that he grew up in Spain, and his family raised sheep. And it was his responsibility for most of his teenage years to go out every day at about 5 o'clock and bring the sheep back in and lock them up for the night so that they would be protected from wild animals. And they had to give him something that was absolutely 100% true in his world. They couldn't just lie to him. They had to give what was true back then. And the truth was, he had a brother named Raymond who worked away from home in town, and he would usually get home at about 6 o'clock. By then, the sheep were taken care of, and the family would eat dinner. And so the family's response to this gentleman became, "Oh, I'm so embarrassed. I forgot to tell you." Now let's pause. That's using an emotional hook. And I talked a little bit about that last time, but when you use an emotional hook statement, you get somebody's attention, you cause them to start thinking that maybe the anxiety and distress that they are feeling in the moment is explained in a different way, and maybe you have something to do with that. And so they'd act embarrassed. "Oh, I forgot to tell you. Your brother Raymond called. He got home early, and he took care of the sheep so you could stay for dinner." And the family told me that when they started using this technique, their dad readily accepted it, and he would say things like, "Oh, well, are you sure it's okay that I stay?" And they'd give him some gentle reassurance, and he'd eat dinner. And after dinner, the problem was gone, because in this man's world, any time he got through dinner, the sheep were already taken care of. He would never have had dinner if he hadn't done his job, because it was a really important job. So I love that example, and have shared it with many people ever since. Now, I also took care of a gentleman named Herb, and every day for a couple of years, Herb would walk up to me in the morning when I'd go do rounds around the community and say hi to everybody and see how their day is off to a start. And Herb would walk up and say, "Just wanted to let you know, I'm going to be leaving this afternoon. I'm moving to Wyoming. I got a job at a hospital there. And so today's the last day I'm going to visit here." And a lot of well-meaning but task-focused and untrained staff members might say to Herb something like, "Oh, Herb, well, I don't think that's going to happen. We're gonna stay here, and everything's fine." And or they might be panicked and worry a little bit more about it. But I learned that in Herb's world, he thought he was working at a hospital, and it was a positive thing that he felt productive. He felt like he was giving back in some way. And so, all I had to say was just what you would do if you were on stage improvising in the moment. If this was an improv act and he said, "Just wanted to let you know I'm going to be leaving this afternoon," I might say something like, "Oh, I hadn't heard. Well, I sure appreciate you letting me know." And then I knew we needed to get him engaged in something in the meantime. And his favorite thing to do in the morning was to exercise, because he had done that for years. And he went off to a place for a long time that he nicknamed the Sports Center. And so all I had to say to him is, "Oh, I'm so glad you let me know. We'll enjoy your company while you're here. Let's go for a walk." We'd come around the corner by the activity room, and I'd say, "Well, here's the Sports Center. Let's go exercise." And in we'd go for our 10 o'clock exercise program. And he would accept it readily and spend all day in the Sports Center. Now, sometimes when a person says, "I have to go home," it's code for something else. Home is a lot less a place than it is a feeling or something that we relate to because of things that we need to do in our lives. Home might mean, "Well, I hate to use public restrooms, and I have to use the bathroom, and I can tell if I leave right now, I have just enough time to get home." Home might mean, "I need to go pick up the kids," or "I need to go make dinner," or I'm tired and I need to sleep. It could be a lot of things. And I took care of a lady named Peggy, who used to every day, between 3 and 4 o'clock, she would come to the secure door on the west side of the building that I was running, and I would hear this little knock. My office was not too far from that door, and so I'd hear this gentle knock at the door, and that knock could go on forever, it seemed like, if we let it. And so as soon as I heard that little knock, I knew it was Peggy. And I would go through a different door, and just to pause, that's really important, because sometimes when I'm consulting, I see people go open the secure door that someone with dementia is knocking on. And that's really not a great idea. Sometimes they'll push past you, or at the very least, you cue them that, hey, this door actually works. So I'd walk through a different door, and I'd walk up to Peggy, and I'd use the long-lost friend approach. And I'd say, well, Peggy, fancy meeting you here. I'd pause, and she'd smile and look at me and say, well, how are you? I'd say, oh, I'm fine. You look wonderful. Oh, it's great to see you. I met you at your daughter's house. And I'd start throwing out family members' names and bring up an experience or two that I knew she remembered, because that would cue her, oh, yeah, this person is a friend. And she would play right along with it. And then I'd say something like, gosh, it looks like I stopped you. You were going somewhere. And she would say, oh, that's right. I was trying to go home. But this door is broken. And I can't tell where I need to go. How do I get out of here? And I came to know, through trial and error and just experimenting with a lot of different things and asking her to tell me about home and bringing up, oh, you're right, but I forgot. What are we supposed to do? I came to know that for her, at 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I have to go home was code for, I'm exhausted and I need to lie down. And so all I had to say to her was, I know right where to go. And I'd offer her my arm like a gentleman, and off we'd go down the hall. And just as we were getting to her room, I would cue her again, and I'd say, I bet you're exhausted. And she'd say, oh, I am. And right then, I'd open the door and say, here's your bed. I'll let you lie down. And she would just say, oh, thank you. And she'd crawl in, and she would sleep. And then 45 minutes to an hour later, she'd get up, and she'd be ready to start getting ready for dinner. So sometimes we even overthink it a little bit. Sometimes all we have to do when someone says, I have to go home, is just agree with them, but delay it a little bit. We can say things like, well, okay, let's do your hair before we go. Or, okay, let's have lunch before we leave. Or we might ask them to help us with something. We could say, okay, but before you go, could you just help me with one little thing? I'm kind of stuck and I need your help. And when we ask people with dementia to help us, it is like magic, because most people don't do that anymore. Most of us are so rooted in reality that we look at this person with dementia and we only see their deficits, and we don't think about the fact that they still have an emotional need to be useful and necessary and to serve others. And we all have that need. You and I get to fill it all day long as we serve other people around us, and it feels good. But when people are living with dementia, far too many people fail to ask them to do the very things that would help them feel important and necessary in life. So quite often we just need to give the person a reason to stay a few minutes longer. Now, all of this explanation I've been giving of what it's like to live in the moment and how we get into that world brings up a few other implications that I'd like to discuss. One of them is that we really should not give more information than the person we're interacting with is capable of processing. A lot of times, even when people have had some of this training and they, on the surface, understand these principles and they really are trying hard to get into the world of the person that they're interacting with, they still give too much information. And if someone can only remember things for 30 to 60 seconds, then usually we should just give the next 30 to 60 seconds at a time. So a few minutes ago I told you about Herb and his desire to go to Wyoming, and I would acknowledge that. And then I mentioned I would tell him, let's go for a walk. I wouldn't start off with, let's go to the sports center, because the very next step, when we were standing there talking in the common area and he was telling me he was going to Wyoming, was to go for a walk. And so we would do that. And we'd be talking as we walked down the hall, maybe commenting on pictures that were on the wall or talking about a story that he remembered. And as we'd come around the corner to the sports center and we could be inside there within the next several seconds, then it was time to talk about that. Sometimes when people walk in the room to do things like escort a resident to the shower room, if we're talking about things in a long-term care facility, sometimes they walk in and they say things like, well, hi there, Mary, and they might have a great connection with her. They might do all that preliminary stuff right, and then they say, well, let's go have your shower. And the problem is, the shower is going to happen a few minutes down the road. That's giving too much information up front. So the first thing that needs to happen maybe is to go for a walk. Hopefully we've got the shower room all set up. We've got clothes in there. We've got their change of underwear. Everything's ready to go so that we just walk in the room and we give them the very next step. If they're lying down and it's time to get up, we just connect with them as a person, and then the very next step is, well, let's sit up and let's stand. And then we go step by step through the process. So any of these invitations that we give to activities should focus on whatever the next step is rather than the whole process. All right, well, let's just pause for a minute. I've gone through a whole bunch of stuff about being in the moment and have given you some examples about what these interactions can look and sound like. Does anybody have any questions right now? Okay. Let's shift gears a little bit then and talk about some of the other things that are affected when people are living with dementia, especially Alzheimer's disease. And a lot of what I'm talking about is related to Alzheimer's, since that's the most common cause of dementia. So we talked about memory, but it's not just the memory centers of the brain that are affected by Alzheimer's disease. The whole brain eventually is affected. So let's talk about what happens when the back of the brain, the occipital lobe, gets impacted with Alzheimer's. The occipital lobe controls our visual processing, and a lot of people with Alzheimer's and other dementias start to lose peripheral vision, they lose depth perception, they don't process movement very fluidly, and they don't see things that are similar in color when they're next to each other very well. When you combine those changes with the fact that as we get older, then the cornea tends to thicken a little bit and things yellow a little bit so that the world visually looks a little different. And a lot of older people have macular degeneration and glaucoma and other eye problems that cause a loss of vision. And most of the time, the people that we deal with struggle at some point visually. Well, if a person doesn't have good peripheral vision, that tells us something about how we need to approach. We should always approach from the front, because if we come up from the side, we might startle them. And when we frighten someone with dementia, it releases a little bit of cortisol, a stress hormone. And the trouble for someone with dementia is that they might be frightened, but then 30 to 60 seconds down the road, they might not remember why they're frightened. But because that brain chemistry lingers for longer and they still feel upset, then they have to start looking around in their current world, finding an explanation for why they feel so bad. Imagine that you went out after this seminar and you had to leave and drive someplace, and you came within inches of a very serious car accident. Maybe someone swerves into your lane, recognizes at the last possible minute because you're laying on the horn that they are about to hit you, and so they swerve and you barely miss each other. Maybe they clip your rear view mirror. Guaranteed you're going to have a cortisol release. You are going to feel all kinds of stress. Your breathing is going to be greater. Your heart rate's going to be up. It's not going to feel very good because that fight or flight response just kicks in automatically. But then a few minutes later, you're still going to be feeling kind of keyed up. And a little bit after that, as you come down from it, you'll start to feel this sense of exhaustion, because an experience like you just had is very, very taxing on the whole system. So not quite to that degree, but in a similar way, if we frighten someone with dementia, they will have that kind of a reaction on a little bit smaller scale. And they will also feel bad a little bit later. And they might look around and see someone across the room and make the assumption, you did this to me. Sometimes I believe there are resident-to-resident interactions that really go south because a staff member who is well-meaning passed by somebody in the hallway, tapped him on the shoulder, and kept on going. And by the time that individual saw the staff member in front of them, the brain was just starting to process, oh, something touched my shoulder. And they might look around and not see anyone and not register that it was probably the staff member that's now in front of them. And so they feel this phantom touch. And imagine what it would be like if you were walking around and periodically something touched you and you never saw it. That would be scary. And I think that it provokes more problems than we understand. Now, if you don't see things that are similar in color when they're next to each other, that has all kinds of implications in long-term care settings or in the home. It really doesn't matter. For example, if we serve someone with Alzheimer's disease, mashed potatoes and gravy and turkey and a Parker House roll, all on a beautiful cream-colored piece of china, it might look nice to us. But to someone with visual deficits, it's kind of just a blur. There's nothing that stands out to tell the mind exactly what it is that they're looking at. There's nothing to cue the person that this is food and you know what to do with it. So it's far better to put things on a blue plate or a red plate or an orange plate. Think Fiesta ware. Bright, vibrant colors that provide visual contrast. Put colored liquids in clear glasses and clear liquid like water in a red cup or another colored cup so that visually we're helping people. A lot of the communities that I go into as a consultant, I'll walk into the bathroom of a resident where the staff has said, oh, we just don't know what to do. This guy goes in and he urinates all over the floor. And it takes all kinds of time to clean it up. But even worse, it's a fall risk. We don't want him to walk in there and slip in his own urine and break a hip. And that kind of thing really does happen. And yet I'll go in the bathroom, and what I'll see is a light-colored linoleum or tile on the bathroom floor, and a white toilet, and a white garbage can, and a white sink, and the toilet is up against a white or cream-colored wall because we paint a lot of rooms with neutral colors. And yet, when you got white on white, for someone with Alzheimer's disease, that is not enough visual contrast. They can't see what they're dealing with. And so, of course, they make it to the bathroom, but then if they can't see what they're supposed to do after that, they might just drop their drawers and urinate on the floor. So in scenarios like that, we can make a huge difference just by changing the color of the wall right behind the toilet and maybe putting on a black or dark-colored toilet seat so that it stands out. Having a countertop around the sink that is noticeably different than the color of the sink so that there's some visual contrast. Make sure that handrails aren't the same or close to the same color as the wall, or else they can't see them to hang on to them. Showering can be a frightening thing, and there are a lot of reasons why people with dementia struggle with bathing. But visual issues are one of the big ones. Most shower chairs that are manufactured are white, and most showers or tubs are white. And sometimes we're trying to get a person with major visual problems that can't see colors that are similar to each other when they're next to one another to sit on a chair that is non-existent from their visual perspective. We've got a white shower chair against a white shower, and they just can't see it. So far better to get either a different colored shower chair or put a colored towel on that white chair. If people don't process movement fluidly, if things look as if they're moving under a strobe light, then it can be frightening, and we need to slow down. And some responses from residents that get labeled as really bad behavior are totally rational responses when you understand how they're visually experiencing the world. For example, if someone was sitting at the table, and let's say that this is a 90-year-old woman, and she's struggling to eat well, and so she spills a lot of food, and she has some food that kind of spills on her chin. And we know that she really has a hard time following instructions and making sense of what we're asking her to do, and it's just going to be too hard for her to take a napkin and wipe her chin. And so if we're well-meaning but task-focused, and we fail with step one, which is to always make a connection with the person, if we just walk up to this 90-year-old woman and we grab a washcloth and we say, hey, you got some food on your chin, as we reach in and wipe it off, she might visually not process that very well. And if we're moving fast and not telling her what we're going to do before we do it, she might see our hand coming at us and perceive it very differently and think we're going to punch her. And if you think you're going to get punched, you only have two choices. You either pull back and try to duck, or you hit first. And when a 90-year-old woman punches her caregiver, usually she gets labeled as combative. And that's when we have conversations with families that sound like, oh, I hate to do it. Medication is really our last resort, but your mom's getting pretty aggressive, and it's only a matter of time before she hits another resident, and we just can't have that. So much as we hate to, we're going to put her on some medication to try to control this behavior. And yet, her behavior in that moment was perfectly rational when understood visually and when we make sense of how she was seeing the interaction. So it's us that really needs to change. We need to move slower than we normally would. We need to connect with people first. We need to show them what we're going to do. We could show that 90-year-old woman the washcloth. We could gently put her hand in that washcloth and let her feel what it is. And we can guide her hand with ours slowly up to her face to clean off her chin. That's what would make a difference. Now, when I share this kind of scenario, a lot of staff members will say, well, I love that approach. That sounds great. But I'm way too busy. I just can't do that. I don't have enough time. I've got to really keep moving along. And that's when I have to jump in and say, now, wait a minute. It takes 30 to 60 seconds to do this right, to really connect with the person and tell them what we're going to do before we do it. And if we do it wrong and we get punched, what do you have to do? Then the staff member thinks and says, well, you got to fill out an incident report. That's right. How long does that take? Well, a few minutes. And then the administrator's got to investigate it and may have to interview you and other staff that were around seeing this happen. And if they don't understand what really took place, then we've got to talk to the doctor and we start exploring options with medication. And all of a sudden, a 30 to 60 second problem turns into a couple of hours that we've spent dealing with it. So it makes absolutely no sense to say there's not time to do it the right way. Now, there are a few other visual implications I want to talk about before we move on. A lot of people living with dementia that are struggling visually really have a hard time with abrupt transitions in flooring. They might be looking at a shiny floor. Maybe it's linoleum that's been polished, and to them, it looks wet or it looks icy. So those types of flooring are not really effective for people with dementia. If there are abrupt transitions in flooring, it might be really hard for them to navigate the space. If you think about coming from a light-colored floor to a dark-colored floor, if you don't have good depth perception, you might perceive that as a step or a drop or a hole. It might be frightening. Even more troubling, I think, for a lot of people, is when there are transitions and they are not clear. For example, if someone with dementia is out walking along the sidewalk and they don't see things similar in color when they're next to each other, you've got a gutter that's made out of the exact same concrete as the sidewalk. And if the asphalt next to that gutter is faded out, it's all about the same color. Well, if someone's walking along and they can't see where that step is, they're likely to just step right off and at the least twist an ankle and at worst break something as they fall down. I took care of a gentleman named Paul for quite some time who had been seeing the same physician for 30 years, or going to the same clinic at least. And at one point his wife took him to the clinic and he walked through the front door and he stopped and he yelled out, "No!" And he would not go any further. His wife couldn't get him through the door and so they had to leave. And he never went back to that doctor's office again. The reason is that they had remodeled, and they had used a very busy kind of carpet with lots of squares and triangles and circles. It was this geometric pattern. And visually, it was all wrong for Paul. He was terrified to walk across that floor, and so he never did again. Now, if you don't see... if you don't perceive depth very well, then narrow hallways just might provoke behavior that is not real conducive in a community setting. if you have a narrow hallway, and let's say you've got two elderly men with Alzheimer's disease who've developed a very flat affect, so they, when you look at their face, they almost look a little bit mean because they've lost the ability to smile. And if they're walking toward each other, a narrow hallway forces them to cross at a closer distance than they would if it was a wide hallway. So as they start coming toward each other and they're in close proximity, if they don't have good depth perception, they might be thinking, wow, he's coming right at me, and he looks mean. And if you think someone's coming after you, you only have a couple of choices. You can turn and run, or you can fight to live another day. You might be thinking, I better hit him first and get out of here quick. And over the years, I have seen people in communities with small, narrow hallways that have residents who struggle. And I've seen those residents move to communities with wider hallways and do just fine because they can pass at a much broader, with much more space in between them. And that makes a difference for them. So lots and lots of implications visually. Does anybody have any questions about visual issues? Okay, well, let's dive in and talk a little bit about speech and language then. Most people with Alzheimer's disease get to the point that they can understand maybe 50 to 70% of what they hear. And their vocabulary also starts to shrink. In fact, by the end of the disease, they might only be able to say 4 to 8 words intelligibly, maybe even less than that. So progressively, they really lose language skills. And sometimes an individual might be able to speak really well, but processes what they hear very poorly. Other times, someone with dementia might have an incredibly difficult time putting their words together, and yet they understand the bulk of what they hear. So we have to be really careful when we're communicating that we understand how language is working for this individual. Now, if someone is only understanding 50 to 70% of the words they're hearing, it means they are very much like someone who speaks that language as if they were a foreign language learner. In the case of English, we might say they're like an ESL speaker. English is a second language. And if any of you have ever tried to talk to someone that speaks another language fluently, and you're trying to get by, it's not very easy. I took a couple of years of Spanish in high school, and I've had lots of employees over the years who speak Spanish, and I've tried to sit in the break room at lunch and have conversations in Spanish so that I can improve my skills. And it's really hard, and I find that I understand only about half of what they say. And it's a lot easier if they will slow down and use simple words and phrases. Well, since people with Alzheimer's are going through that same kind of scenario, we have to slow down, and we need to use simple words and phrases. There have been some studies done over the years that show people with Alzheimer's can process about 7 word chunks at a time. So if we can communicate using 7 word chunks, it makes a big difference for people. And all we have to do is give a phrase and then pause, and then give another phrase and pause. Now, if you've ever communicated with someone that doesn't speak your language very well, you may have also had the experience of recognizing there is a heightened sense of nonverbal behavior in that interaction. And essentially, the person that doesn't speak the native speaker's language very well has to really key in to what their face is doing, what their gestures are telling them, whether they seem happy or irritated, and what they're pointing at. So there's this heightened nonverbal awareness, and it happens without our even recognizing it. People living with dementia have that same kind of experience, and they don't even realize it, but they key in heavily to our nonverbal communication. We communicate a lot of things nonverbally. And for the people that we're around living with dementia, often we do nonverbal things that communicate very negative messages. For example, if I was to walk up to any one of you on our conference today, and you were sitting down, and I walked up and stood right next to you and just kept talking, I would be in a very dominant position. I would be nonverbally communicating that I'm in charge and you are not. And it feels very uncomfortable. I love to do this with my college students, because I'll walk up to them and invariably they will pull back a little bit. They can't even help it because they feel like I'm popping their bubble, so to speak. I'm in their space, and it's uncomfortable. People living with Alzheimer's and other dementias feel a profound loss of control. And when we walk up to them and hover over them, we heighten that sense that they have lost control. We tell them all the time, you are not in charge. But if we'll just get down below their eye level, or at least at their eye level, what we tell them is, you are important and you are in charge. I value you. I'm putting you in control. And that becomes incredibly important. So one of the key things we can do in our communication is to always approach at or below eye level. And we should be smiling, because they're living in the moment. They're on the stage doing improv. They don't know how they're supposed to feel. They're like a little child who's playing along in the same room as mom or dad, and then a total stranger walks in the room, and the child runs to mom or dad's side, holds their hand and looks up, and doesn't even have to say anything. They're just looking to see if mom or dad is okay with this stranger. Is this a good stranger or a bad stranger? And people living with dementia will do the same thing. They will look around in their environment for cues to tell them if they are safe or not. And so when we approach at or below eye level with a very warm, genuine smile, most of the time they feel that things are really good. Even if they're being angry and upset, if we can be incredibly calm when they aren't, it's powerful. Unfortunately, a lot of times when someone gets agitated and upset, facility staff or even family members get really nervous and scared, and they get worried they're going to get punched, and so they want reinforcements. That's when a staff member, for example, will say, oh, she's just really mad. I need you to go in with me. And pretty soon you have two or three or four people going in the room, and nonverbally, we're communicating, we are here for a fight, and we're scared, and you better be scared too, because now it's 3-on-1. How much better if we go in by ourselves, get down below eye level, and just smile? And someone living in the moment will often be totally disarmed by that. They will recognize that their behavior is not congruent with what they're seeing and with all the cues in front of them. And I have watched many people just melt on the spot as I was being uncharacteristically calm when they were not. Now, there are some interesting implications with speech and language when we understand how the brain deteriorates. For most people, the right side of the brain deals more with rhythm, and the left side deals more with language. And for most people with dementia, they lose language ability faster than they lose the ability to understand rhythm. That's why many people with Alzheimer's disease can appreciate music late into the disease process. But that gets us into all kinds of trouble when we communicate, because speech has a music to it. There's rhythm to our language. There's a cadence to the way that we speak. There are pauses. We can ask a question just by using the right pitch variation. So I'll say that again, and I'll turn it into a question. We can create a question by varying the pitch. See how the pitch of my voice went up a little bit? That tells any of us, oh, he's asking a question. Well, unfortunately, a lot of us don't pay attention to the fact that people with dementia might be responding to the music of our speech, to the rhythm and the pitch of our speech, a lot better than they're processing the words. They might understand the pauses, and they might say, uh-huh, okay, yeah, interesting. And we think that they're getting what we're putting out there verbally, and yet they're not. And this will get us into a lot of trouble, because if our nonverbal behavior doesn't match exactly what we're saying, they might nod and seem to be in agreement, and yet they're really just processing the nonverbal message. For example, let's suppose that somebody is really at risk for falling, and that individual has a horrible accident and wets themselves and recognizes it. And so they're really motivated to get into the bathroom. So they manage to get to the commode by themselves, and we come in the room and see that they're sitting on the toilet with soaking wet pants, and we want to assist them. And so we walk up to them, we acknowledge what's going on, and then we start telling them that there are some clean clothes in the other room, and we want them to sit where they are. And we don't pay attention to the fact that our hands start pointing into the other room where the clothes are, as we're asking them to sit still while we go get those clothes. If this person is responding to the music of our speech and our nonverbal behavior, that individual might agree, we think, to sit still and to stay put. And in reality, they're agreeing to what they think we're really telling them. They think we want them to get up and walk to the other room. And so we turn around to go get those clothes. They stand up to follow, pants around the ankles, and they trip and take a header right behind us. And it was really our fault, because our nonverbal behavior did not match what we were trying to communicate. So we have to be very careful that everything is congruent, that all the levels that we're communicating on make sense. Now, let's shift gears and talk about a few other things that change with the brain. A person with Alzheimer's often will lose the ability to sequence a task. They might get dressed in the wrong order. They might have their underwear on the outside of their clothes, for example. And yet, a lot of people will walk up to someone with dementia and will say things like, oh, we need to go fix your clothes. We don't want you to be embarrassed. And yet, a statement like that makes absolutely no sense to the individual, because when they've lost the ability to sequence things, all they know is they're supposed to put these things on. They don't understand putting them on in a particular order. And so it gets very upsetting, very confusing to them when we try to say that they've got things on in the wrong order. So step one is always to connect with the person. So if Susie walks out of her room with three layers of clothes and her bra kind of on the outside and not even on all that well, just sort of hanging there, and she's got her Depends on the outside of her pants, and she's proudly walking down the hall, we're not even going to call attention to that. We're going to walk up to her and connect with her as a person And we're going to say, well, Susie, fancy meeting you here. Or we're going to say, Susie, oh, it's so good to see you. It's your friend Eric. I remember we met at your daughter's house, and we might pull out something that she recalls. So we connect with her, and as we walk along, we might reinforce, oh, it's just great to see you. And we might guide the walk right back to her room. We might get in there and say, I noticed that this, we might hold her bra a little bit and say, I noticed that this looks a little uncomfortable. I bet it would feel better if. Then we start gently moving through, kind of rearranging things. And we keep the friendly flow of conversation going as we help her gently rearrange things. A lot of eating problems are related to sequencing issues. If we're staring at a plate of food and there are several things to choose from, we might not know where to even start. And all of us eat food differently. Some people mix and match their food. Other people separate their food carefully and they eat one thing and all of that one thing until they move on to the next thing. And we need to talk to families and try to figure out how this person typically ate, if we can, and recognize that they might be sitting there staring at a plate of food because they just don't know what to do first. But if we get them started, then they can go a little further. Sometimes when I do cognitive testing with people and I'm really evaluating people and then I look at their functional needs, I might go in the bathroom with them and have them brush their teeth, especially if I'm seeing them right after a meal. And it's always interesting to see how they start to do the task. If they can't even identify the toothbrush, then I know I have to do at least that. If they don't know how to put the toothpaste on the toothbrush, then I've got to fill in that gap in the sequence. Sometimes I've handed people a toothbrush with toothpaste, and they've looked at it, and then they started dabbing it on their face as if it was a makeup applicator. Well, that tells me, okay, we've got to help them get the toothbrush in the mouth and start the motion of moving it. So we can experiment with people and find out how much of the sequence they need help with. And it's only our job to fill in the gaps in the sequence, not to do the whole sequence, unless they're in such late stages that they absolutely cannot do any of it. Now, hearing also gets really affected. People with dementia have a hard time processing and filtering excess noise and distraction. If you think about the last time you were in a really crowded restaurant where it was hard to even hear yourself talk, and you tried to have a conversation with someone near you, I think you'd agree that's a really frustrating experience. A lot of people living with dementia have to eat in dining rooms that are far too noisy. For one thing, a lot of staff members leave a TV on, or a lot of family members might have a TV on, or there might be a lot of excess conversation. Frequently, I go into facilities to consult, and I see staff members assisting residents to eat, and they're in their space, they're trying to help them. And yet, because the resident is really focusing, trying to process what they're doing, trying to do all these complex mental tasks that are involved with eating, the staff members recognize, hey, there's not a whole lot of conversation going on here. We've got to liven it up a little bit. And so the staff members start talking to each other, saying things like, hey, what did you do Friday night? Oh, really? You went on that date with him? Oh, you've been hoping to go out with him for a month. That's amazing. Well, the next time you want to know what that's like to the person with dementia, try doing calculus in a room full of noisy people. And a couple of those people are standing right over the top of you, and you're trying to do very complex math. Not easy at all. So people with that are living with dementia are going to do a lot better if we keep the dining room really quiet so that they don't have to process all that extra distraction. They're going to be able to participate in an activity better if there's not a lot of distraction. If we're doing an activity in a common area where there are staff members talking over in this corner and people are coming and going through a secure door, and you got a family over here talking to one of their loved ones, and we're in that space trying to do meaningful activity, then we are asking those that we're caring for to do calculus while we shout in their ear, basically. And it doesn't work very well. And that's one of the reasons a lot of people don't stay engaged. Many people with dementia lose the ability to attach meaning to non-language sounds. So the sound of an oven timer or a smoke alarm or a chair alarm, if chair alarm's in use, or the sound of someone knocking at the door, those sounds, for many people, get to the point that they are not meaningful sounds. So we have to be really careful. And a good exercise is to just sit still for 60 to 120 seconds in the space where this person with dementia is living. Just sit there and write down every single noise you can hear going on and start focusing on it, in on it, paying attention to it. People with dementia struggle with taste and smell. Both senses are greatly diminished. And you don't have to work with people that are living with dementia very long to realize that they generally have real sweet tooth. Even people that didn't like sweets earlier in life tend to have a sweet tooth because that is what they can taste. Well, sometimes we can leverage that to our advantage. We might put maple syrup on green beans or even chocolate sauce on things because that's what they can taste. Sounds terrible to us, but I've seen people over the years eat things they wouldn't otherwise eat because they could taste something again. If someone's taste and smell are really deteriorating, then we can't tell an individual she smells bad and needs a shower because she can't smell herself. So that doesn't make any sense at all. People living with dementia tend to become very disoriented. Usually they're disoriented to time early on, and then they're disoriented to place. They generally retain insight as to who they are and who their immediate family members are for a lot longer. But when time and place are impaired, that causes a lot of problems. People are looking around in the moment trying to figure out this stage that they're on, so to speak. Procedural memory, though, stays intact much longer. Procedural memory is not the memory of what we did, but it's how to do something. I took care of a lady for years who every day thought she was in a hotel, and she thought that it was the first day that she'd been there. But after 2 or 3 weeks of living in that community, she knew where her room was. She knew it was right around the corner from the dining room. And she could get up from the table and go there and never miss her room because her procedural memory was a lot more intact. Now, this idea of procedural memory and learning how to do something and remembering how to do something really matters in community living and in the home, because it explains why routine is so important. Anything that we do very routinely, people with dementia are more likely to understand. They may not be able to tell you what the routine is, but they can appreciate it and they can go through the routine. That gets a lot of professionals into trouble because in a lot of the communities I go into, I see calendars that are very different on Saturday and Sunday than they are during the week. Some places have very little activity going on Saturday and Sunday. And when I talk to staff members, they'll say, well, those are family days. Well, I agree that a lot of family members visit on Saturday and Sunday. But if the routine looks radically different, and if there really isn't meaningful activity to engage in throughout the day on Saturday and Sunday, then calling it a family day is just code for we have nothing to do. And when people that are living moment to moment to moment have nothing to do, they will find things to do. And it is the job of caregivers to set the tone, to set the channel, to dictate what it is that happens throughout the day. And it needs to be done in a routine way. Otherwise, Saturday and Sunday really fall apart. Monday and Tuesday, we're left picking up the pieces. We have piles of incident reports to follow up on, and we're just trying to get things back to normal. And then Wednesday, Thursday, Friday go pretty well, and then we rinse and repeat and do it all over again and keep making that mistake again and again and again. So we can really leverage a person's ability to remember procedurally how to do things if we just keep it routine. A couple of things as we wrap up, a couple of additional principles. Motor skills often get impaired. Usually people with dementia lose fine motor skills, and then they lose gross motor skills. They often quit using utensils in the reverse order as they learned to use them in. And as time goes on, for most people, falling just becomes part of their experience because the brain loses the ability to keep the body upright and to help them move through space. We can really help preserve some of those skills a little bit longer if we are keeping people exercising and engaging, if they're using their motor skills routinely, it's easier to hang on to them for longer. If we're helping them have physical activity early in the disease process, then we're helping them maintain for longer. And even if they start to fall, they'll be more likely to catch themselves. I'd like to end by pointing out one thing that has pretty significant implications for people living with dementia, and that's their reaction to pain. Pain is a hard thing for people with dementia to understand. Their brains often don't tell them exactly what's going on. They have this vague sense that they don't feel good, but they can't tell you, oh, the arthritis in my knee is flaring up and I feel awful. For many people living with dementia, their experience with pain is just like a teething toddler. You might have a sweet little toddler that is normally just an angel child. And boy, when that toddler starts teething, he's biting and kicking and drooling and things get miserable. And parents can recognize, oh, he's teething. He hurts. A lot of time when people are living with dementia and they start acting aggressively, they're just trying to tell us that they hurt. Something is causing them pain. And so one of the first things that we should try when people are acting aggressively is to really root out whether or not they might be in pain. Maybe give them some Tylenol and see how they respond. Or even more effective pain medication that's a little bit stronger if we strongly suspect pain. That is one of the very first places to start, and far too many people jump right to antipsychotic usage, which is not going to help if it's a pain issue. Well, we've covered a lot of ground today. We've talked about a lot of different things that people see and perceive and how they experience the world. I hope that's been helpful to you, and I hope you're able to go out and immediately start putting some of these things into practice with those that you're around who are living with dementia. I look forward to having you back in a few days for the next segment of our course, and I'm excited to share more exciting ideas with you at that time. Hope you have a great rest of your day, and I will talk to you real soon. Thanks.
The host has joined the conference.